And in 1997, I picked up the phone to her and I said, I'm caught now at a crossroads in my life and I don't know what to do, but I think I want to start my own foundation to address bear farming directly as a local group, not as an international group, but as a local entity. And on the phone, she just said three words to me, just do it.
Are you in your 20s at a job you really don't like? Are you retired and bored? Are you stuck in a rut and can't see a way out? Fact is, the biggest barrier to getting onto the next curve is you. That's right. It is never too late or too early to be who you want to be. My name is Dee Sterling. I'm a businesswoman and presenter, and we are back with our new show, Second Carvers. We will reframe familiar problems and let you take control. Are you a second carver ready to be ignited? Jill Robinson, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hello, Dee. I'm okay. I've actually, you can hear, I picked up a bug from when I was in the UK. So I'm not at my best today, but I'm feeling very jolly and very happy and grateful to be on your show. So thank you for inviting me.
Listen, I'm beyond excited to meet you here. And you look absolutely fabulous, as I said, like a total rock star. So it's all good. So Jill, I'm in London. I know you typically are based between Hong Kong, China, Vietnam, and traveling around the world on various initiatives. Where are you today?
I'm in China. I'm at our Bear Rescue Center here. And just over there in the distance, I can see two bears swimming in their swimming pool in this hot, hot day here in Chengdu.
Oh my God. And so even that image in front of you just probably makes all the work of all these years worthwhile, right? I mean, absolutely incredible. So Jill, you have been really a mega pioneer and, in my view, a warrior of animal welfare in Asia since 1985. And you are widely recognized as the world's leading expert in and campaigner against the bear bile industry, which is truly horrific. And we're going to come on to that. But you've been campaigning in this space since 1993. I always like to go back to the beginning of stories, and we all love a good story. 1985, you get off a plane in Hong Kong. Tell me about that.
Oh, gosh. It was, well, all surrounding my then husband, John, who sadly died last year.
I'm sorry.
And we'd been separated, you know, for the last few years, but nevertheless, he was still one of my best friends. He was one of the founding members of Animals Asia. And chairman of our board, even after we separated. But cutting back to that time in 85, I joined John in Hong Kong. He was an airline pilot for Cathay Pacific. And it was surreal. You know, I'd never been to Hong Kong before. And as soon as I got off the plane, I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, I've come home. It was as simple as that. You know, I loved the people. I loved the territory. I loved the food. I'd never found food that I loved so much before I came to Hong Kong. And I just, it's a vibrant, exciting, hardworking, fast-paced city. Everybody says that, you know, and you're immediately plunged into this universe of such an incredible lifestyle, you know, where people work hard and play hard in equal measures. And the years since 1985, what are they? They must be, you know, nearly 40 years, have gone in the blink of an eye.
So when you landed, you know, you've been in the corporate world, I understand, previously. What did you think you were going to do? Were you just going to look for another job? Because fairly quickly, you engaged in what was going to be the direction of your life, right? You know, working for the International Fund for Animal Welfare to start with. But how did you go about working out what you're going to do?
Yeah, you're right, Dee. It's a real strange question because I knew I wanted to do something. And I immediately thought, because I'd been working with the BBC and Thames Television in the past, that the natural sort of focal point would be going into media. But I went for a couple of interviews and I was completely underwhelmed and just thought, oh, I don't know, this isn't for me. And then there was a fateful day when I was just looking over the wall of our place in Hong Kong onto the beach, and I saw a guy walking his cat. And I just thought, oh, that's a bit strange. And I waved over the wall. I said, oh, I think I'm one of your neighbors. I'm a new neighbor. And he came over and introduced himself. And his name was David Dawson. And he was the Asia representative of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. And I'd always supported I4 back in the UK. So I just said, oh, if ever you need a volunteer, I'm your person. And he did. And so I started working for free for David, first of all. And then he started paying me a part-time salary and then a full-time salary. And then he left Hong Kong with his wonderful wife, with whom I'm still best friends with both of them.
Amazing.
Even now. And I took over his role, you know, all those years ago. And the rest, as they say, is history.
You know, I always say there are no coincidences. You know, in a way, that was that encounter set you on a journey of a million miles, not even a thousand miles, right? And Jill, if we go forward a little bit, it's been quite well documented that you repeatedly saw cases of animal cruelty. And it was a bit like a drum that was getting louder in some respects, I sense in your head. And you found Dr. Dog as well at this time, which is an incredible animal therapy program. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think as you're right, gosh, that's a great way of describing it. The drum roll was getting louder and louder. And, you know, even in Hong Kong, you'd see dogs that are designer dogs that have been thrown away by people that, you know, just didn't want them anymore. Dogs that, you know, had become popular because of their breed or because of, you know, some latest fad. And you'd see these awful, skinny, skeletal, starving dogs, you know, just out in the streets. Of course, you'd go across into other countries in Asia where you'd go to the live animal markets and see thousands and thousands of a million dog trade where they're obviously eaten. And I just thought, oh my goodness, if people in Asia, you know, perhaps looked upon dogs as I used to, you know, in the West as our friends, could there be, you know, a different mindset? And so it was just, if we could connect people with dogs as the valuable species they are, you know, helping humanity in all sectors of social awareness, you know, from customs dogs, from guide dogs for the blind, hearing dogs for the deaf, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just reading a Pets as Therapy magazine brochure one day in my office. And I looked on the floor and there was Max, my golden retriever, and the dots connected. And I just talked to Max. I said, you can do this, Max. And I sold up hospitals, disabled centers in Hong Kong, and consistently got people crashing the phone down and saying, really, as many did, you're not seriously suggesting bringing a dirty, unhygienic mutt into a sterile hospital environment. And I said, yes, that's exactly what I'm suggesting. And if you read the science on this, you'll see that number one, it works, it connects people. And number two, these are not dirty, unhygienic dogs. They belong to volunteers who are passionately along for the ride and want to see dogs making a difference in Asia. And that's how Dr. Dog began.
And how did you keep going? Because at the beginning, it was you with Max. What kept you getting up each day and fighting the path?
Just being buoyed. But I mean, I tell you that after the there was one day when the matron of it was a hospital, the Duchess of Kent Hospital, a children's hospital in Pock Fulham. She said, I've heard about animal therapy. You've got 1 hour in the garden with one dog. And honestly, that's all it took. I rang up the South China Morning Post. I got them to come along. They were taking pictures. The story the next day saw my phone ringing off the hook from people that wanted to be volunteers with their dogs, from more hospitals, more disabled centres that wanted to have the healing benefits of animal therapy. And from that day, I haven't looked back. You know, it was just a wonderful synergy of people really getting the fact that dogs are good for our physical and our psychological health.
I mean, and how, right? And I think you've got more than 1,000 dog therapists now, right?
Yeah.
Which is just incredible, just incredible. So continuing on this theme, Jill, you some while later had a life-changing event, which led you onto another second curve for you. You know, we talk about getting onto the next curve and the next journey of our life in some respects, which is what you did. So you had an encounter in southern China with a bear in a cage. Tell me about that. I mean, it must have been so emotional, but can we just go back and can you talk me through a little bit that experience and what happened?
Yeah. Gosh, I mean, it was just so long ago, but the memory is like it was yesterday. It was 1993, April. And I just had a call from a friend of mine who was a journalist who said he'd come back from a notorious bear farm in China. And he suggested that I go along. And I grabbed a couple of my friends because I didn't really know what the bear farming industry entailed. I knew nothing about moon bears, the subject of this terrible practice on the farms. And we went across, joined a group of Japanese and Taiwanese tourists, and we went onto the farm. And the bear bar farmer was trying to encourage everybody to buy bear bile, but he wasn't showing everyone where the bear bile came from. It was obviously an industry secret. So we just snuck away. My friend had told me where the basement was, where the bears were being kept. And we went downstairs and we came across 32 moon bears in cages so small that they could hardly move or turn around. And their eyes just followed us around the room. It was just the most haunting, exceptional experience, I think, that's almost indescribable to relate. And it was quite dark as well. So every time I got close to one of the cages, I kept hearing these strange vocalizations, like the bears were popping,
right,
making popping sounds. And the closer that I got to the cage, the louder and the more frantic these popping vocalizations became. And at one point, I felt something touch my shoulder, and there was a female moon bear, and she had a paw through the bars of the cage. And I turned around in shock because I thought, I'm obviously in trouble here. I've gone too close to a cage. And you know, today you would never, never even get close to cages. You know, the bears know those cages. When you're on the bear farms, when you're watching them, you've almost got to have a sixth sense, but your eyes are everywhere because they know their cages much better than you do. And they know where the holes are. They know where they're coming apart, da, da, da. But honestly, I just turned around and she had her paw reaching out to me, and it did really, really stupid, almost like reactionary, I suppose, without thinking. I took her paw and I just felt the warmth of her pads as her claws and her pads just, you know, squeezed into my hand. She just squeezed them. She just squeezed my hand. The picture, the photo evidence is there. That's exactly what happened. And I just looked into her eyes, and it was just a moment lost in time. And I never saw her again, but that one gesture by that one bear changed the course of my life. And that one bear was responsible for everything that Animals Asia is today, every single thing, all these years later, 25 years later.
25 years later. But can we just momentarily, for those that don't know, and can you just unpick what bile farming is? I mean, it is a truly horrific practice. I think many people don't even know it goes on. And it's really, you know, made the plight of moon bears, it's an endangered, they're also called endangered Asian black bears, right? You know, even worse across the globe. And this exploitation, you know, you're working to make it stop. But can you just explain a little bit what happens?
Yeah, of course. So moon bear involves the incarceration of well over 12,000 bears across the Asia continent for use in the bear bile industry. And this is where bears are immobilized, of course, so that their bile can be extracted from the gallbladders that are in their abdomens, in the same way that our gallbladders are in our abdomens. In Vietnam, they are drugged with illegal ketamine, and they have their bile extracted after they're unconscious, after they've been pulled out of the cage, and after the farmers are using an ultrasound machine, believe it or not, to locate the location of the gallbladder, and then putting in something like a 6-inch spinal needle, which he stabs around until he's pretty certain that he's found the gallbladder. And when he is certain, he'll take the needle out of the sheath, he'll lick it to make sure that he's tasting the bitter tasting substance, which is the bile. And then he'll pop it back into the sheath and he'll extract about 100 ml of bile. Now, luckily in Vietnam, bear farming is now illegal, although there are still around 300 bears still in cages and still, of course, being illegally extracted of their bile, because many of the farmers, of course, are not going to waste the time that their bears are in the cages, even though the industry is illegal. So they will still be, you know, away from the government's eyes, extracting this bile. In China, the method is slightly different, where the bears are victims of something called the free drip method, where a hole has been obviously cut into the gallbladder and to the abdomens of these bears, and something like a fistula or a free drip hole has been created so that the bile freely drips out. And this is, you know, I mean, it's something that I've always said is reminds me of medieval England.
100%. It's prehistoric. Jill, what is the life expectancy of a bear being treated in this disgraceful, inhumane manner?
Who knows? You know, it can range for weeks on these farms to up to 30 years, just depending on the bear, how stoic the bears are, how strong, how they've come through the obviously infection that ravages their bodies. And the whole pathology of these animals is, it would take me a year to describe, but, you know, to go through some of the areas, you know, they involve obviously heart problems from stress-related issues. They can obviously develop severe mobility issues as a result of not moving properly in a tiny wire cage for their entire life, for years, if not decades. They very often become victims of cancer, multiple cancers across their body, especially liver cancer, ironically, which is, you know, one of the organs that bear bile is used to treat in human terms. They have blindness as a result of stress as well. They have multiple teeth problems and dental problems. They're very often caught illegally in the wild, so they're missing their limbs. You know, when we lay the bear on the floor after we've rescued them from, you know, the cages on a bear farm, you look at them and you think, where on earth do we start? What can we do? How can we help this bear? You know, because the scene unfolding itself is, where do we start? You know, it's a catalogue of disease and sickness for these bears.
So, Jane, when you met that beautiful bear that, you know, held your hand in 1993, some years later, you founded Animals Asia. Tell me about that journey, because clearly that was a life-changing event, something that you could never, will never forget your entire life and beyond. When you went back home to Hong Kong afterwards, how did that experience evolve into founding Animals Asia?
Obviously, first of all, I was just so shocked by what I'd just seen. And I wanted to believe that it was some sort of witchcraft or, you know, cultural belief that had no substance. But I had a very short, sharp shock when I did some investigations and immediately discovered that actually bear bile had been used for millennia in traditional medicine. And also that the essential acid called ursodeoxycholic acid, or UDCA, had also been chemically synthesized since the 1950s in the West. So not from bears, but because people realized all those decades ago that actually there was something in this UDCA and something in bear bile that could really treat illnesses in humans. And so that was the first shock. The second shock, I think, was after I sat down and spoke with traditional medicine doctors, first of all in Hong Kong and then later in China and in Vietnam, where I was told multiple times, of course, that bear bile could easily and cheaply be replaced by herbs and by synthetics.
Absolutely.
And I think it was that eureka moment that no one was going to die for the lack of bear bile, and that we could explore without upsetting culture, without upsetting traditional medicine doctors, without pointing a finger. You know, we could explore the fact that, you know, no one was going to die for the lack of bear bile, and that we could hopefully work constructively and positively.
Without being, you know, acting in a way which is, can create conflict, I guess.
Right, exactly that. So in the industry, you know, so that, you know, hopefully bear bile could be replaced and the farms would shut down. And I think it was, you know, we were allowed by the Chinese government to close down many of the illegal farms in the country, and then latterly in Vietnam.
But Jill, I do want to come on to that, but this was a big initiative, right? This is not just go and have a couple of conversations, get the press involved, and even that for a lot of people would be overwhelming, you know, create a story. I mean, how did you practically just get going and start to get traction? It's not like you're in your home country. You know, there are cultural dynamics and forces at play across China, different dynamics and similar ones also in Vietnam. I mean, where did you start and how did you just keep the wind at your back to keep moving forward?
Well, we did publish a story, of course, of that first visit, and we got, you know, people across the globe just writing in absolute, you know, shock as a result of what they were seeing, the images. This was the first time bear farming had been exposed across the world. And now here it was, you know, with people just wanting to know so much, but I think most of all, wanting to know what we could do about it. And one of those people was a Hong Kong businessman. In fact, a Hong Kong legislator who called me up and said that he had friends in Beijing that might be able to help us. And those friends were members of the government, members of the forestry. And so we got introduced to them. And it was a remarkable meeting because, you know, they had said that there were many illegal farms. They had said that, you know, in many instances, bear farming was cruel. And it wasn't so long after that meeting that this legislator, David Chu, he said, I've got some land in southern China. I'd be prepared to help build a sanctuary there. And that the government officials said, we'd be prepared to close down an illegal farm. And those two, you know, points in the universe came together, if you like. And suddenly we were building a sanctuary there. And it was, you know, years later that, you know, the trust between us and the forestry officials became more and more. And when Animals Asia was created a few years later in 98, that we also had another Hong Kong businessman who I was invited to go for breakfast to help us raise money for a sanctuary, another sanctuary, a big one this time. And I wasn't sure where this was going, but within half an hour of meeting him, he said, I'll give you your first $1 million. It was quite unbelievable, you know, to make that impact, to start, give us the confidence of signing on the dotted line with the Chinese government to build the sanctuary that we've got here today in Chengdu, in Sichuan province. And then, of course, move on to Vietnam and work with the government there on a project that would end bear farming once and for all in Vietnam.
So tell me a little bit about the daily life in the sanctuary. What's the flow of the day? If you think about the first one, you know, where you are today, where did you start when you got the sign off, you got the cash in the bank, et cetera, et cetera? Tell me a little bit about that journey.
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, you've got to remember all those years ago. I mean, this was decades ago. And what we knew about moon bears, really, you could write on a postage stamp. But, you know, we did call on expertise across the world. You know, Boris, another of our founding members, he would go across the world and look at bear enclosures, bear sanctuaries, and you look at how you can, you know, proactively and safely keep bears contained, keep them captive, you know, in a sanctuary situation. Because we knew, obviously, of course, that bears are very inquisitive. They're very curious. They can go up, under, and through enclosures. And they are, you know, they're a megafauna animal. So they are extremely strong, extremely unpredictable, all the rest, blah, blah, blah.
So, and they can't leave, right? Just so I'm clear, when they've been through this horrific experience, they're not able to go back into the wild, right? Is that correct?
Many of them haven't learned the skills to survive. But I think more importantly, many of them, because of the pathology, because of the both physical and psychological issues on the bear bar farms, they need a lot of medication, most of them, every single day. So you can't release them into a forest environment because then you're not able to give them the drugs, the medication that they need. So obviously, when we build a sanctuary for life for these bears, for their 30-year lifespan. So it was literally going out into the community, asking vets if they'd had bear experience, you know, having them join our vets, you know, in terms of anesthesia, in terms of the surgeries to remove their damaged gallbladders, to start helping funds, raising funds to provide the equipment that we need, you know, even down to X-ray machines, which are life-saving. You know, all the stuff that we needed, you know, it was just piece by piece by piece over the years to be able to get to where we are today, which I truly believe are the finest teams in both China and in Vietnam, with the capacity, the training, the know-how, the knowledge, and the equipment behind them to be able to really categorically say, you know, that Animals Asia, I think we are the foremost organizations in both countries, you know, not just for rescuing bears, but understanding bears and their pathology, you know, in the Asia continent.
Absolutely. And the numerous rewards and recognition that will come onto that you've received over the years is also testament to that. Jill, what have been the biggest challenges to you on this journey?
Quite a few, really, I have to say. I think no more than, you know, anyone might not disbelieve it is funding. You know, it's as simple as that, you know, because with more funds, we can do much, much more. And we're at the stage now where we've been invited by the Vietnam government to build the second sanctuary in Vietnam to help rescue the last remaining 300 bears now on farms across the country, so that by about 2026, when the sanctuary is built, bear farming will be done. It will be finished.
I mean, what an accomplishment, right? I mean, that's a big one. And what an example to other territories.
It's huge. Right, exactly that. It's huge for us. And we jumped on it. You know, we knew the challenges. We knew that, oh my gosh, raising millions and millions of US dollars, even when facing a challenging time ahead in terms of looking after these bears. That when we've rescued 680 bears over these years now, Dee, you know, and bears are not cheap to keep and feed and manage and clean and, you know, medicate and the staff behind them as well. It's not cheap. We've got 400 staff, you know, in Animals Asia, where we grew from, what, you know, 5 founding members. So it's a huge, huge program. But when the Vietnam government presented us with the, you know, the challenge of building this second sanctuary so that bear farming would end, and they stood on the stage with us as they did in 2017 and said, we are committed to ending bear farming. And they ratified that last year, again, on the stage in a public press conference, together with celebrities and the media along with us, that if this second sanctuary was built, Vietnam would has no more bears on farms. Once the last bear came to us, that is the end of bear farming. So, of course, we had that sense of urgency to do just that so that we can finally see the conclusion of what we started, our founding goal all those years ago in 1998.
Well, what hope that brings. Have you ever felt like just giving it up because it was too much?
Never. Never. We've had dark days. We've had dreadful, dreadful dark days. And I can't, you know, there is a book in the works and, you know, I'll be talking about that because we've been, you know, we've been victims of eviction campaigns by corrupt officials in the Tam Dao National Park in Vietnam, where we have the first sanctuary. And I remember being told by, you know, old Vietnam hands in the USA, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning in one phone call where he said, you know, you might as well pack your bags and leave. You're not going to win this one, Jill. When we, you know, a corrupt government official wanted us, a national park official wanted us out so that he could build an entertainment facility, believe it or not,
right.
Where our sanctuary
was. I know. And the irony.
Oh my gosh. And he'd got the army involved and, you know, the Ministry of Defense, and this old Vietnam hand said, just pack your bags. You're not going to win this. And we just persevered. And we persevered because we have the most exceptional staff on our team. And this was none other than Tuan Bendixson, who's our Vietnam director, who fought the fight of his life, bringing everybody along with him and bringing supporters across the world along with him in something called Stop the Eviction Campaign. And we won. We got the Prime Minister's support. And in the end, this national park director was retired. and we live to fight another day. But there are many, many stories like that.
Oh, I totally can imagine. And, you know, some of these aren't just regular challenging business problems, shall we say. Like some of these are a little bit closer to the edge, right? Where you could almost feel in danger or feel that, you know, your staff could be subject to threats, et cetera,
oh my
et cetera.
Gosh.
I mean, that is big stuff. What did you learn about yourself going through some of these extremely, extremely hair-raising and challenging?
I think to be more trusting, Dee, not just to trust in the universe a little bit more, maybe than my cynical mind wanted to, but to trust in the fact that I think people are generally good at their heart, and to start understanding more why bear farmers would be farming bears. And not just because of the finances, you know, but because I think many of the farmers genuinely believed, of course, as we know, that bear bile works, and wanting to help the community, trusting government officials who, some of them, it has to be said in Vietnam, were indeed bear farmers themselves. But then again, trusting the process of working with them, building up the trust levels with the traditional medicine community, who ultimately then agreed that, you know, prescribing bear bile wasn't particularly in harmony with nature, which is what traditional medicine dictates. And then working more strategically on this so that there would be no embarrassment to the country, to the government, to the local communities at all. And it's now, I think, Vietnam especially has set a template of not just behavior change, but cultural change as well.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's such a shift. It's so groundbreaking.
It's everything. It's everything. You know, we've got the Vietnam government, again, standing proudly on the stage with us, saying bear farming is ending. We've got the traditional medicine community that also made a pledge they would not sell or prescribe bear bile. And that's a community of some 70,000 members. And those same doctors are now holding clinics every month to bring the local community along to be then prescribed the herbal alternatives to bear bile. And a herbal alternative that we are now investing in together with a local company called Cocoon, who is producing tens of thousands of vials of this herbal alternative so that it then goes out into the community who trial it and say, yep, it's as good as the bear bile we used to use. So it's just bringing schools along to start constructing the herbal gardens that, you know, growing those herbs that can be sold back into the community, and so that they can then go home to their parents and talk about their experiences, many of the parents of whom have been bear farmers and are now changing, you know, their minds about this, or at least being more willing to give up their bears, you know, now that bear farming is illegal in the country. So it's a massive holistic step forward in terms of so many community levels that shows that we can work totally together without loss of face, humiliation or embarrassment, and celebrate this endangered species of bears as well. And the fact that, you know, they've contributed towards processes and healing people, but now it's their time, and now they've earned their place, if you like, in the fact of promoting the herbal alternatives instead.
Totally. And it really makes me think about, you know, you've created this incredible real life ecosystem, and all these different initiatives are steps towards where you've gotten to today and all this change. And, you know, bringing people along on the journey is so fundamental. I mean, you think of the thousands, if not tens of thousands of people that have been on this journey, directly and indirectly, the re-education, the negotiations and all the rest of it. And it reminds me that in life, it does take time to make things shift, doesn't it? You know, we're in a kind of democratic world, at least in the West, where prime ministers and presidents in office are on a relatively short cycle. The big stuff that really needs to be dealt with. So don't get me onto climate, which is one of my favorites. But other issues such as too much sugar in processed food, or too much fat, or too much salt, they all get put on the back burner or are not dealt with sufficiently because we don't take a longer term, more holistic view, which you've done. And Jill, you know, obviously, all these years later, so much has been achieved. This landmark situation in Vietnam. I think, you know, you with the Chinese government had the first agreement between a Chinese government and an NGO to set up the sanctuary and so forth in mainland China. Can we talk a little bit about the bears and your relationship with those bears? You know, tell me about that.
Oh, my goodness. They teach us new things every single day. You know, again, our learning curve has been absolutely vertical since the very first time. We learned, of course, how stoic they were, and perhaps that's one of the reasons why they've been used in the bear farming industry. But we've also learned how forgiving they are as well, and how much can be achieved by, you know, bringing in the relative expertise that they need, you know, to deal with the pathology as well. And just seeing their lives completely change around. You see them bursting out of their dens every day. You know, they've had their medication, they've had their pain removed, they've been integrated with newfound friends, even though they're not, you know, said to be not a social species or particularly social species in the wild. You know, now we're seeing massive, massive change with individual bears that came in violently aggressive very often, or without hope, having learned hopelessness, as we call it, you know, and it's just total shells and broken bodies have been completely changed to the point now that they are happy, healthy, bouncing bears that swim in pools, you know, investigate their enclosures. It's almost beyond description, you know, and I have to say as well, you know, if I can, that it's not just changing the lives of the bears, but it's changing the lives of people that are working with them.
Oh, I'm sure.
Changing the lives of local communities. One really exciting thing I have to say in Vietnam is that our goal in about 5 years' time is to have the second sanctuary that I've been talking about today, entirely run by our Vietnamese staff. So absolutely. So we've, you know, our amazing team run by, headed up by Heidi Quine, for example, has been doing capacity training, bringing in intern vets, young vets that are now no longer interns, they're junior vets. And they are going on to take over the whole veterinary capacity of Bacmar, of the new sanctuary.
Incredible.
As are, you know, our whole administration team, our bear managers, the whole team, the whole thing.
Such a community effort then, isn't it? A local community. It's wonderful. Do you feel the bears are like your children?
That's an interesting question. I feel inherently close to them. I feel spiritually close to them. I feel as close as anyone can be to another being. It's as simple as that. We all, you know, when the bears, for example, pass away, we have the most incredible ceremonies, both in China and in Vietnam, where we celebrate their life. We all know them so well that we bury them with their favorite toys, with their favorite food, with a poem that's read in Vietnamese, in Chinese, and in English. And we celebrate, you know, the lives and the names that they've been given for the first time in their lives. They've never had a name on the bear farm.
Of course, right?
So they have a name with us. They have personalities and characters that are utterly understood.
Who comes up with the name?
It just depends. It just depends. We have a nickname for them, first of all, so they immediately get a name. So we're just about due to rescue soon two more bears, and apparently they've been given the name of Bonnie and Clyde.
Love it.
Everybody comes together to choose those names. It's a, you know, but that's going to be probably temporary nicknames, because then we have people that can choose, you know, obviously allow, give us funding and can have a name for life. They can give us a name for life. So, but I say one more thing. We, you know, in terms of their capacity to understand us as well, it's not just us understanding the bears. We have something called, you know, the cooperative care. And this means that we are asking the bears to engage in their own cooperative care. So, for example, we have a bear called Zebedee, and he came in, smashed over the muzzle. He had horrible pathology of his nose and muzzle. He'd lost many of his teeth. And consequently, you know, we've had him for about, 15 years. And all these years later, our vet team need to keep checking his mouth just to make sure that everything is okay. He's got a fistula at the top of his mouth that opens every now and then, and they have to keep checking that. So instead of anesthetizing Zebedee and other bears that we need to, you know, have on a health check on a more regular basis, for example. We ask them to join us. And for example, Zebedee is trained, but that, you know, that we hate the word training, but it, we don't hate the word training, but it's got connotations, obviously, of service training. But we ask Zebedee to open his mouth, to show us his mouth so that we don't have to use an anesthetic to anesthetize him and bring him in for a health check. And we've got, I think, about 40 bears now that are engaged in their own cooperative care.
Unbelievable.
Giving us their arms for blood pressure or to take blood or to open their mouths or to look in their ears or to have x-rays of their arms taken, of their limbs taken. They are doing it willingly where they can walk away any time they choose. But no, they're coming to the front of their dens and saying, yeah, we're going to work with you on this. And they do.
Just incredible, right? And testament to the unbelievable work that you've been collectively doing. Jill,
well,
can I ask you?
Our senior managers, Sarah in Vietnam and her team and Molly and team and Ryan and team here in China, again, kudos to them. All of these people are bear whisperers. Amazing.
Totally, totally. I mean, it takes a village, as we know, right? Per bear. So this is a slightly strange question, but I am fascinated. If you think about the bears, and I'm not going to ask you to choose a favorite because that would really be grossly unfair. But if you think about a bear that you've had a particularly close relationship with, I mean, we couldn't necessarily call them bear mentors because they can't speak the way we speak, but they speak in other ways. If you think about that bear, or one that's particularly in your heart, what would be the one or two things that you've learnt about life and living and about how you live through that reverse mentoring?
Oh my gosh. I mean, one of the things I keep saying is forgiveness. And a bear that was the prince of forgiveness was Jasper. He was the peacemaker of the sanctuary. And since Jasper, we've had many, many bears that we now call peacemakers. And everyone knows what we mean when we talk about.
Isn't that beautiful?
Get in the middle of the odd disagreement. You know, so he's saying, come on, guys, let's break this up, you know. And he'll come over curiously to the fence line, you know, whenever there's a crowd there or visitors there or, you know, even one person. I would often say here in China to the team on my walkie-talkie, if I'd had a bad day, I'm going to switch off for an hour and I'm just going to go and have a meeting with Jasper. And they all knew what I meant, you know.
Oh my God, I love that, right?
And
that is how it's meant to be. We are all meant to, you know, we can only exist in harmony with life and nature in all its forms, right? And I think we've forgotten that over you know, the industrialization of the world and so forth. So if we come to today, Jill, you know, from seeing that bear in that cage and literally going down another road in life, right? It literally was life-changing and you went onto a new curve. Fast forward to today, you've got hundreds of staff in offices around the world. You're in China, Vietnam, and Germany, in Australia, in the US. You've received multiple awards, way too many to list here, but I do want to reference that you got an MBE from our wonderful Queen Elizabeth. And you also, this is one of my personal favorites, if I may, you got a You Bring Charm to China Award, which recognized you as one of 12 prominent foreigners in China who've enriched life there in different ways through education, business, environmental protection, and so forth. You've been recognized as one of Asia's top 100 philanthropists for your contribution to animal rights in the region. And on and on. You've presented across the world. You've been interviewed on all the big TV channels. You've been in documentaries. And, you know, you've also made documentaries. I was looking at To the Moon and Back, which everyone must watch, which is incredibly touching and beautiful. If we come to today, looking out on the horizon and any potential new curves, what does life look like for you?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, just, I think it looks increasingly satisfying. I think, you know, I look over here now and there's three sleeping bears in the grass.
You have to send me a picture after of those bears.
And I just know that Animals Asia is in the position now where we have the finest team in the world. Really, I can say that without any hesitation. and two sanctuaries and soon to be three sanctuaries in the best, best place to be able to perhaps carry this mission long, long into the future after I've joined those bears in their grave. And I mean that without any, you know, morbidity at all, because, you know, we're already talking about succession planning and team building. And, you know, we have strategic planning meetings every year where, you know, bear farming has ended in Vietnam. It will be done by 2026. And we can, you know, form that as the example, as you said, for other countries to follow. And then now for other projects to follow as well. What will these sanctuaries be in 2, 3, 4 decades? I have no idea, but I won't be there. But what I do know is that we have the best legacy in the world of competent and passionate bear carers who care deeply, not just about the bears and the other animals that we help, but about the culture and our staff and the country in which we have the privilege to be based here in Asia, in China and Vietnam. So I am extremely fortunate and relieved and happy that, you know, things are in safe hands and that we have the best supporters in the world that will keep that momentum going, I'm absolutely sure.
Absolutely, because you created the Oceanic Swell over days and months and years of effort and highs and lows and slog, and it's brought you to this point. And I think, you know, today we can think about all those hundreds of beautiful bears that have been rescued and that are being looked after in many cases and, you know, allowed to live the life they're meant to live, even if it's not in the wild. You know, you've changed a practice, right? And I think, you know, you've changed the hearts and minds of many because you care. And this is a word that's coming up a lot in our conversation. The fact that you cared to actually do something about it, you know, got you to here, you and an army with you. What I'd like, just in terms of wrapping, Jill, is for you to give advice to everyone who's listening, because you've been through so many, down so many roads, on so many journeys, and you took some pretty brave decisions along the way. And, you know, you decided to act. You decided to do something. What would you say to someone today who, you know, maybe they're doing a job they hate or they're in a relationship that's broken and they need to exit, but they're struggling and they want to get on and follow that little flame inside them and work out what it is, that little special seed of brilliance, or simply they feel strongly about something and don't know how to get off their chair and get into the street and get doing to do something about whatever that is. What are the couple of things you would say to that person?
Well, the same thing that a very special woman said to me many years ago in 1997. Many will remember Virginia McKenna, actress, founder of Born Free, who was a woman I fell in love with when I was about 8 years old.
Right, didn't we all? Seriously?
Didn't we all want to be Virginia McKenna? Yeah. And then I had the privilege of meeting her many, many years later in Hong Kong. We did some investigations together. And in 1997, I picked up the phone to her and I said, I'm caught now at a crossroads in my life and I don't know what to do, but I think I want to start my own foundation to address bear farming directly as a local group, not as an international group, but as a local entity. And on the phone, she just said three words to me, just do it.
Yes, just do it, right?
Those three words were enough for this young woman then to just do it. And in fact, because they mirrored what my father used to say from when I was a young kid. My mum died when I was a baby. I didn't know her, but my dad always said to me when I was in equal quandaries about things, hit it hard, just hit it hard. And to this day, I say when I don't want to get out of bed in the morning, really, and we all have those days, is just hit it hard and I get out of bed. And to anybody, you know, like, you know, we all know that there's going to be pitfalls ahead. We all do. But so long as you would like have a laser focus of what you really want to do, don't just think you want to do it. You have to know you want to do it deep within your heart and your head. And if you have those combinations coming together, then you're just going to do it and you should do it.
Jill, on that note, I mean, there's almost nothing else to say apart from the fact that you are such an inspiration to me and millions. You have done incredible things, and I'm super excited to see what the next act looks like as you keep on this journey. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, Dee, thank you so much. A privilege. Wonderful to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Dee here. I hope you enjoyed this incredible episode with my amazing guest. I hope you're enjoying the series. We'd love to hear from you, so do DM me and tell me all your stories of second curving. Lots of love.